This is the September 11 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Ellen Dearden from AgriView. She's in Morton, Illinois. We'll also be joined by Garrett Toy from Stockton, Illinois and AgTraderTalk.com. They'll discuss this morning's USDA crop production and world agricultural supply and demand estimate reports. But before that, we'll hear from Matt Darrow. He is with Kipler out of the United Kingdom. I spoke with him pre-report this morning, not about what USDA's expectations might be, but about the Black Sea logistics and how wheat and corn are moving out of those areas. We're now joined by Matt Darrow. He is at Kipler in the UK. He's the grains and oilseeds analyst there. Hi, Matt. Thank you for taking some time with us today. You and I are talking prior to the USDA report, so we're going to concentrate on logistics. Let's first start, and logistics in just one area of the world, the Black Sea. Let's start just with the importance of that area, Ukraine and Russia in particular, to the grain and oilseeds markets.
Yeah, of course. Hi, Todd. Yeah, thanks for having me on. So obviously, there's been a lot of disruption across sort of the grain trade, particularly the wheat trade across the Black Sea, following the escalation and conflict between Russia and Ukraine, which kind of started around mid-July. What occurred had been Ukraine had sort of increased its sort of drone strikes across sort of the Sea of Azov in Russia, which impacted the vessel movements there. And it kind of evolved into a much wider attack across not only the vessels in the Sea of Azov, but of course infrastructure as well, which led to a strong retaliation from Russia, and ultimately leading to a loss of export capacity across those kind of the three key Black Sea ports for Ukraine, which is Chernomorsk, Odessa, and Yuzhny. And then you've also lost the key kind of Black Sea ports for Russia as well. So you're looking at, less operation at the key Black Sea ports for Russia. So that would be Novorossiysk, Tuapse, Taman, and then also the vessels that come out of the Sea of Azov. To kind of try and put a number on it, when you look at kind of the volume of sort of Russian wheat across sort of the global market, it's about 25% of global wheat trade. And then Ukraine is about is around sort of 10%. In a typical year, it's around 10% of global wheat trade too. So, you know, we're looking around about a third of global wheat trade is being impacted by the conflict, by the escalation conflict, and the kind of the loss of export capacity that we're seeing for either of these major exporters. And then if we kind of drill down like a little bit more and look at kind of the terminals that are being more impacted. So we talk about those key three ports for Ukraine in the greater Odessa region. Last year that accounted for over 90% of Ukrainian grain trade. So, you know, Ukraine is typically, it's a country which relies heavily upon the volume or the movement of grain out of the Black Sea. You know, it's not really, it's not as reliant on kind of the movement of grain overland west into the EU or, you know, that kind of rail or kind of trucking movement. It's very, the kind of the railing infrastructure there is kind of oriented around a very strong seaborne export campaign. So when we're looking at kind of those three key ports, you know, over 90%, so that's a strong hit on total Ukrainian export capacity. And then we kind of look at Russia as well. We're seeing that Novorossiysk is about 40% of Russia's total wheat export campaign on average, you know, in a typical year. And then also for the Sea of Azov, it's around 25% too. So collectively, you know, we're looking at around almost two thirds of, you know, total Russian wheat export capacity is being impacted by this escalation, and where we're seeing a loss of activity. So that's why the wheat market obviously has been reacting quite sharply to the events that we've seen over the recent weeks, but now months. We're becoming increasingly sensitive towards, you know, any kind of news of peace deals or any ceasefire agreements, which could see a revival of trade out of this kind of key export kind of hub for both Ukraine and Russia.
You mentioned peace. The United States and Turkey both have been working through this process. How do you see that proceeding?
To touch on Turkey has been trying to work on a memorandum or some sort of agreement to at least involve a ceasefire against sort of commercial vessels within the Black Sea. Now, that would be massively important, and that's one of the factors that the market's trying to keep an eye on there, because that's the big pain point for grain exports out of the Black Sea at the moment, is that you have a much higher war premium being factored into vessels that are moving grain out of these regions. We've had the unfortunate incidents where grains have where vessels, sorry, have been struck by attacks from either side, which obviously is leading to a lot of ship owners being quite hesitant, understandably, to move grain from these kind of key export ports. A ceasefire there would perhaps encourage some vessels to pick up grain from these key terminals, and therefore see a little bit more grain come out of either Ukraine and Russia. But we're yet to see much interest from Russia. Their kind of stance has been a little bit hesitant to really push through with a ceasefire agreement at the moment. And of course, we did have some US officials meet with Russia last weekend, as well as Ukraine. And we also had President Trump speak to President Putin recently as well. So there's been a number of developments of, obviously the US getting involved as well, trying to broker a peace deal. But one of the challenges that keeps coming up is the territorial dispute. And how does, is there a concession of land that needs to be granted to negotiate that peace deal? And how does Ukraine feel about that? And how does Russia feel about that? So, in the sense of how Ukraine's responding. So it's a very challenging situation, and unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be much. While we hear reports that talks and dialogue are positive and constructive and progressive, we're yet to see a much of a material change to the situation that's taking place, and we continue to see strikes, Ukrainian strikes on Russian infrastructure, as well as Russian strikes on Ukrainian infrastructure, which is continuing to debilitate the export capacity for either country, unfortunately.
To this point, how have the global flows of grain been impacted in the marketplace?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as it stands at the moment, we've got Russia, just to touch on how so Russia's been trying to move some of their grain inland to the Baltic seaports. But those kind of seaports are already quite a actively involved in moving coal and fertilizer products. So while there might be some export capacity you can pick up there, we're only talking maybe 200,000 tons a month. Which is a far cry from what we usually see out of the Black Sea ports. So they aren't really able to offset that lost export capacity from alternate export hubs. And unfortunately, the same is the case for Ukraine. Ukraine's trying to move grain south to those Danube ports, and then move it along, sort of barge it out towards the Black Sea, and then there's a transshipment that takes place, typically in this kind of European seawater, just as sort of outside of Romania. But ultimately, those kind of volumes again are unable to offset the loss of export capacity that we're seeing at those kind of key Black Sea terminals, or deep seawater ports, deep water seaports. Sorry. So ultimately, this is kind of leading to a constriction of trade from Ukraine and Russia, and the global market, has been, monitoring the situation very closely. And has also been trying to understand, well, how long could this go on for? Because ultimately, we saw very low export volumes come out of Russia and Ukraine for August, and now we're looking into September. We're not really seeing much of a revival. So we are seeing some of those key wheat importers begin to get a little bit itchy when it comes to, how long can they wait out for until they need to come to market to pick up wheat. So, for example, we had the most re one of the re more recent tenders is the one from Saudi Arabia, which was around 500,000 tons, and that didn't come to anything. They said that, they didn't believe that the offers were suitable for them, so the tender wasn't filled, as it were. So that is almost acts as a little bit of a bellwether in the sense of, these kind of key wheat importers, which typically don't usually find their tenders unfilled. Are obviously, not yet willing to pay at the current price in the market. We also had Pakistan have come out with a recent tender, which I think is around 0.75 million tons, so a larger wheat tender. after Pakistan's long absence from the wheat market, and that also will act as a good indicator as to how willing are these key wheat importers are to pay the higher price that we're seeing in the market at the moment. We do know, obviously, you've got Egypt as well. We're seeing on the Khetra terminal, we're seeing low wheat imports for Egypt, and but that's obviously in consideration that they've had larger domestic crop. So at the moment, we aren't seeing the same kind of import activity for Egypt. But it's worth bearing in mind that there are some reports that suggest that some of those flour mills in Egypt have seen, the rise in wheat has kind of been stronger than the rise in flour. And as a result of that, they're not in a position to import wheat to then re-export the flour as actively. So that's also kind of calming the import demand there. So we're seeing, to try and sum that up, we're kind of seeing some of these key wheat importing destinations, which typically pick up the kind of Black Sea grain, be a little bit hesitant to, pick up wheat from alternate exporters, which obviously is kind of asking for a higher price. But we are seeing, on the other hand, we are seeing some other countries pick up wheat. So, for example, Indonesia is already showing a little bit more activity with regards to Argentine wheat. And we're also seeing a little bit more strength from the Australian wheat export campaign too. So, we are seeing a little bit of hesitancy, and some countries are still waiting to see whether we'll see lower wheat prices, in light of perhaps a ceasefire or a peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. But there are already some countries, for example, in Southeast Asia, which typically would, seasonally would import Black Sea grain at this time. They are beginning to pivot away and look for grain from alternate destinations, such as Australia, such as Argentina, because they can't find the same kind of supply there. And they're going to kind of the next best option from a price competition point of view.
The primary export season for wheat in the Northern Hemisphere generally are the summer and early fall months. Are you concerned that may not be the case really for Russia and or Ukraine?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's definitely part of the challenge. This situation has flared up around the third quarter of the calendar year, which for both Russia and Ukraine are typically, or seasonally, have always been the most strongest quarter of exports for grain across those kind of four quarters across the calendar year. So it's coincided at a time when we are expected to see a lot of harvest pressure, particularly in the wheat market. So it is of concern, because where do you push these volumes to? Now, there's reports that both Russian and Ukrainian farmers are using sort of grain silo bags to help store this so it doesn't sort of deteriorate in quality. And you can use those to store grain for up to close to around sort of 12 months. So the supply is still there, albeit with very depressed ex-farm values. So that's one of the factors that is bearing in the mind of those trading the market, is that, we still have a lot of Russian and Ukrainian grain to export. It's just that we don't have the export capacity to move it. So taking sort of a bullish position is of course risky, in the sense of, well, if they negotiate a peace deal or a ceasefire and we see a revival of trade out of the Black Sea, that leaves those exposed to what could be quite a strong flush of Black Sea grain. Now, I'm not saying that there will be a ceasefire or peace deal. We need to keep eyes on how those develop. But at the moment, yes, we would typically see a big flush of Ukrainian and Russian grain the third quarter, but we're yet to see that. And whether that could occur later in the season following a de-escalation of tension is definitely something to look out for. But at the moment, that grain is still very much available, but it's not being able to kind of reach the export market.
Thank you much, Matt.
Thank you, Todd.
Matt Darrow is with the logistics company Kipler. Garrett Toy from AgTraderTalk.com now joins us from Stockton, Illinois, to go through the numbers released by the United States Department of Agriculture at 11 o'clock this morning and how the trade reacted. Hi, Garrett. Thank you so much for being with us. Let's start with the numbers from USDA. Can you tally those things that you thought made a difference?
Yeah, well, first things first is there really weren't very many surprises. Corn production came in at 15.8 million bushel. The trade was looking for 15.785, so we're only off by 15 million bushel. Corn yield came in at 178.5. Trade was looking at 178.2. So there's no surprises on the production side. Acres, minimal changes. So we didn't get any surprises out of the FSA acres this month like we did last year in August. But similar with soybeans, beans came in a little bit bigger than expected, 4.535 million bushel versus 4.501 expected. That was on slightly larger acres, 85.9 million versus 85.775 expected. So a small uptick in soybean yield, 52.8 versus 52.5 expected. You know, corn carryout actually came in about 40 million bushel higher than expected. They offset a lot of that production cut with a feed residual cut of 150 million bushel, which I think is just positioning ahead of this stocks report at the end of the month, because you know, the USDA will adjust in the market's mind that 2025 production was overstated, and that is being held in place by that feed residual number. So they'll cut production, they'll cut feed residual. It won't be, you know, 1 to 2 sort of thing. You know, they'll cut feed residual 1 bushel for every 2 bushel that they cut out of feed out of production. Excuse me. So I think they're positioned there. So they did increase old crop exports by 25 to 3.425 billion bushel. And that's the thing that's interesting to me on this corn S&D, is because they really didn't make many changes on the world numbers. You know, obviously we have this well-advertised drought in the EU. You know, and they left, you know, actually they increased EU corn production by 0.4 of a metric ton. So it's 50.6 million metric ton, when you had some private estimates out this week that were as low as 46 million metric tons. So, if this EU crop number continues to, get cut down the road, that means more imports out of the EU, which also means that, you know, Ukraine, which is typically the supplier of corn into the EU, considering the conflict that's going on there and the limitations of Black Sea exports, that shifts more export demand to Brazil, Argentina, and the U.S. So I don't think that story is necessarily over. Once we get through the supply side questions, that's where the demand side will be looking at. So at the end of the day, I mean, it was a friendly report. We were, you know, corn was kind of following beans have been weak all day. You know, the macros, the outside markets, crude's down 3. Kind of everything that happened yesterday is being undone today. So corn was down, traded to 423 on its lows. After the report, we rallied about 8-9 cents, and now we're, you know, up a couple cents, 1 to 2 cents. But beans have been under pressure all day. They were down 25, 30 cents. We rallied back to like 13, 14 lower, and now we're back 28 lower. But I will say, you know, some of the, this is a correction in the spreads. We noted to clients this week that, and a lot of this is, you know, soybeans are a demand story, obviously, and soybean oil, and with the rally in crude above $100 yesterday, you know, soybean oil is supported by diesel, which also traded to $5 a gallon for the first time since 2022 yesterday. This is only the second time it's ever happened in history. So the spread between November beans and December corn, you know, this week traded to the second highest level that it has ever been. So, you know, it may seem drastic right now. We've only 2023 was the only other year where you know, the premium of November beans over diesel corn is bigger than it's been this year. And I would suspect that that spread probably corrects between now and into early October as we get into, you know, harvest a little bit more full throttle, and the propensity for producers to sell beans off the field.
So you're thinking the price of beans will remain under pressure?
I think versus corn, yes. I think that, you know, corn will be supported, beans will be pressured here. Right now the spread is about $7.70, and the record, you know, the record for this week was back in 2023 and was about $8.70. But if you look at historical trends, there's two other years where we've been like this. 2021, which was coming into that phase one trade deal in 2022, which also was coming on the heels of the trade deal. And both of those years went from, you know, $7.50 premium down to $7. So we, you know, beans lost about 50 cents versus corn in 21 and 22 between now and, you know, the middle of October. Now, 2022 was the only year that actually recovered from that and traded back towards $8 into delivery and in November. But I do think that, you know, it's possible, considering we've got pretty gosh darn good prices here in beans, and I think the farmer will reward those rallies, especially shore up cash flow and you know, stop interest, which interest rates keep going up as well. I do think that, you know, for the near term, I think, considering, you know, beans have rallied, you know, almost, you know, 80 cents, you know, it's possible that we could give some of that, you know, or even most of it back here in the next couple of weeks.
Are you of a mind that once we've given that back and harvest stops, that beans will again find support, and will that come from the RFS and the crush in the United States?
I do. I think it's just, you know, we're caught here between overall bullishness of the ag sector and grains and inflation and everything and harvest. You know, it's, you know, there's just a lot of supply coming on the market in the next 8 weeks. And once we get past that, we'll get back into, and I think that you'll find funds willing to buy this weakness. But you've got $100 crude. You know, I've been friendly kind of all along on the inflationary front aspect of it. Beans have been a demand market for a year and a half because of the RFS. Corn kind of sneakily hid a demand market because of the size of the carryout. But we've had multiple years, you know, gosh golly, multiple years of $4 corn finds a lot of demand, you know. I don't think that, you know, corn will see the export program that we've seen in years past. You know, last year we were really aided by the lack of a bean export program, so we had nothing to ship but corn last year. So that's how we can sell or ship 3.4 billion bushel. But you know, I think at the end of the day, you know, corn exports will still be strong. You know, we've got Argentina kind of undermining us right now because their crop is 6 million metric ton bigger this year than it was last year, and that goes all to export. But this, you know, this Brazilian crop is being used at home. It's not being exported anymore. So you're kind of just robbing Peter to pay Paul out of South America as far as where your export origins are coming from.
Hey, thanks much. I appreciate it a lot. We'll talk with you again soon.
All right. Sounds good. Thank you, sir. Have a great weekend.
You too. That's Garrett Toy. He is with AgTraderTalk.com out of Stockton, Illinois. Ellen Dearden from Ag Review in Morton, Illinois, now joins us to discuss this morning's USDA reports and how she sees that playing out. Hi, Ellen. Thanks much for being with us. If it's okay, I'd like to mostly stick with corn. We can talk a little bit about soybeans if you want. But I would prefer to stay with maize, corn, across the globe, and certainly here in the United States. USDA managed to find a few bushels less per acre this time around than the last. What did you think of the numbers when you saw them today?
Well, on the domestic side of things, pegging the national yield at 178.5 really kind of falls in the area that the trade has been looking at. I thought the more interesting thing was that we saw harvested acres drop. We saw planted acres up just a hair, but harvested acres dropped below what the trade thought about and below what it showed a month ago. Once that trend starts to reduce the percentage of planted acres into harvested acres, typically that continues. So I would not be surprised to say that the harvested acres at 88.5 might even be shaved on this next report. You know, it takes yield and it takes harvested acres to line up with production. And production did come in at 15.8 billion bushel. And you know, that's large, but it's not as big as 17 billion bushel a year ago.
That harvested acre number drop was not small exactly. It was 100,000 acres going from 88.6 million to 88.5 million. I would assume most of those, and I've not seen a breakout of any kind, but most of those probably came out west in the Dakotas, I would think, because of the drier conditions and maybe because of silage, more silage being taken as well.
Yes, and I've seen some pictures on the internet. Of course, you know that's got to be true, of folks in North Dakota who were zeroing out, had an insurance claim at a zero on production, so we're just mowing that corn off. But I thought it was interesting that only in Iowa did the corn yield go up in the Midwest now. Only in Iowa did the corn yield go up from a month ago. And, you know, we did see some changes in the periphery in Kansas and, in Texas and the like. But we really didn't see much of a change in the Midwest on corn yield except in Iowa.
Yeah, and so Iowa's yield is, what, 219? Illinois at 209. That was down from 212 or thereabouts, I believe.
So we're bumping up the corn yield in Iowa, but not seeing that same trend elsewhere in the Midwest.
And Nebraska was off, Minnesota down, I suppose Indiana as well. When you think about this in a grander scheme, where do you think corn between now and the gut slot of harvest might head?
I would anticipate, based on the December futures, and keep in mind that September futures go off the board on Monday, basis the December futures will probably bounce between 510, which is lower than where we've been this week, and probably getting up close to that 549 and three quarter high that we made the 1st of September.
Those are good numbers going through harvest, given where we are today, I would think.
Yeah. I think we'll spend more time on the bottom side of that than the high side. I thought it was interesting, too, Todd, that the EU corn crop, they had it pegged down to 50.6 million million metric tons, and the imports, they bumped up to 23.5 million metric tons. The EU always exports some corn and imports some corn, but that import's going to be huge this year.
What else are you watching in the marketplace, or what else did you see in the WASDE that you thought was important?
I really didn't see a whole lot. Feed use down a little bit, you know, and we're not seeing ethanol demand for corn bouncing up again. I wonder whether part of that might be because ethanol exports to Canada will be likely cut given the trade war that we're having, the tit for tat. Tariffs on goods into Canada.
Some of the analysts we talked to have begun this week changing their attitudes as to what producers should do with corn. And you mentioned a range for December corn, and that would be going across the scale. What producers should do with not only that corn, but maybe with corn that they have in the bin as well. Have you begun to change your attitude on that at all?
I've always been in the idea that we've got to store some corn, and I've been looking at instances where we've got July corn futures up in this 555 to 565 range. Maybe, you know, sell futures there, wait to lock in basis, but that's for bushels that you can store on farm. I hate paying elevator charges for storage. It just doesn't seem to work out in the long pull, but I would think that any kind of bounces, if you've got to move more crop at harvest because of your storage configuration, then you probably need to be using any bounces up towards that 535, 545 range in December corn futures and get those bushels sold.
Anything else before I let you go?
Let's just make a comment on Brazilian 25 corn harvest was raised 2 million metric tons, and that was really the answer in the world-ending stocks for 25 crop being bounced up. World stocks stocks of beans remain rather tight, world stocks of corn getting tighter as we move into the 26 crop. On the bean side, I can't get too excited, Todd.
Why not?
Well, I think we've already outstayed our best opportunities for beans.
Thank you much. I appreciate it.
Okay, bye.
That's Ellen Dearden. She is with AgReview in Morton, Illinois. Joined us on this edition of Commodity Week, along with our other panelists, including Garrett Toy of AgTraderTalk.com out of Stockton, Illinois, and from the United Kingdom and Kipler, a logistics company. We were joined by Matt Darrow. You've been listening to Commodity Week from Illinois Public Media at willag.org. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.